This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's a podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks so much for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of October 27th, 2025. Governor Katie Hobbs on Wednesday announced she'd direct $1.5 million in federal pandemic relief funds to support food banks in the state. SNAP benefits, or food stamps, are set to run out for hundreds of thousands of Arizonans on November 1st because of the ongoing government shutdown. And as Catherine Davis-Young reports, that's already driving up demand at Arizona's food banks.
For about three blocks leading up to St. Mary's Food Bank in West Phoenix, traffic is just inching along.
We're 100 cars deep, three lanes wide. It's spilling out into Thomas Road.
Jerry Brown is a spokesperson for the food bank. As the hundreds of cars slowly move forward through the long line, volunteers load their trunks with boxes of produce, pantry staples, and even soda. St. Mary's is the state's oldest and largest food bank, and Brown says these waits have been getting longer for a few years now as inflation and the costs of living stretch family budgets thinner and thinner.
We've seen a huge jump in the number of seniors because they're on fixed incomes. While inflation has jumped 9 to 10%, their paychecks have stayed the same.
But in just the last few days, this line has included a lot more first-time visitors. Newcomer Cecilia Bencomo is here because she just found out her SNAP benefits won't be coming through on November 1st.
I was like, what am I going to do? I have kids in the house, so.
You do, yeah.
Yes.
How many kids?
I have three kids.
Bencomo says her partner's paycheck is enough to cover the family's rent and bills, but she's been out of work lately, so for about a year they've relied on SNAP to cover groceries. The monthly funds she gets are usually just barely enough, she says. As the federal government shutdown approaches 1 month, the USDA has told states not to issue funds for SNAP recipients for next month. A message on the USDA website says, quote, "The well has run dry," and it blames Democrats for the ongoing shutdown. Bencomo worries about what that might mean for her family.
I'm upset. I'm sad about it because I don't know what I'm going to do. It's very frustrating.
In Arizona, more than 887,000 people rely on SNAP for monthly food assistance. Households get about $180 per person per month. Governor Katie Hobbs has said without federal payments, there's not enough money in the state budget to keep the program running.
We're looking at every way we can to mitigate. We're going to really count on our nonprofit social service community to step up and be partners, helping fill some of those gaps.
Attorney General Chris Mays is suing, along with several other states, saying the federal government does have a contingency fund that could keep SNAP running during the shutdown. But the USDA argues it can't legally use that fund in this situation. Meanwhile, November 1st is fast approaching. The Arizona Department of Economic Security, which administers SNAP in the state, is directing Arizona SNAP recipients to local food banks like this one if they need immediate assistance. So Brown says St. Mary's is just bracing for a lot more demand.
We're a large food bank. We have a lot of resources. We have a fantastic donor base.
But Brown says St. Mary's doesn't know how long the shutdown will last, how long SNAP funds will be frozen, or how far its resources may have to stretch.
I mean, in September, there was $155 million that was paid out to SNAP recipients in Arizona in September. We can't make up that number. That's not a number we can shoulder.
The food bank is asking for more donations and more volunteers, but Brown says inevitably,
the lines are going to be longer. There's going to be more people.
Michael Andrews says he sat in his car more than an hour before he got to the front of the line at St. Mary's. He's also a SNAP recipient coming to a food bank for the first time. He already used up all of the SNAP funds he received for October and didn't quite believe what he'd heard about benefits pausing in November.
Yeah. Is that true? Nobody's going to get food stamps on November because of the government shutdown?
That's what they say.
If I don't get it, I'm going to be in a serious bad way.
After today's long wait, he says he's grateful at least to be going home with a few things to eat. But to him, the situation feels extremely frustrating. Before he drives away, he has one more thing to add.
Hey, tell the government to quit around and go back to work.
Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
in tribal natural resources, which is supported in part by a grant from the Katina Foundation. Last month, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave an unusual speech to top brass in which he rallied against woke ideology and hyped the recently rebranded Department of War. He also weighed in on a long simmering controversy involving the Battle of Wounded Knee, where hundreds of Lakotas were killed by the U.S. Army. Many consider that conflict a massacre and have called for the soldiers to be stripped of their medals of honor. Hegseth dismissed the idea as political correctness run amok and released a video defending the soldiers and their medals. As Gabriel Pietrazio reports, it was a painful message for tribes throughout the country.
Under my direction, we're making it clear without hesitation that the soldiers who fought in the Battle of Wounded Knee in 1890 will keep their medals.
Although bipartisan efforts in Congress to rescind those medals go back decades, only a president has the legal authority beyond the Pentagon itself to undo that distinction.
This decision is now final, and their place in our nation's history is no longer up for debate. We salute their memory, we honor their service, and we will never forget what they did.
In what would be the final chapter of the Army's century-long Indian Wars campaign, as many as 300 Lakotas were killed at Wounded Knee in South Dakota, while at least 25 U.S. soldiers died. A rifle shot rang out when troops tried disarming a surrendering encampment on December 29, 1890. In that confusion, the mass slaughter of mostly unarmed men, women, and children ensued. Army General Nelson Appleton Miles penned in private, quote, "I have never heard of a more brutal, cold-blooded massacre than that at Wounded Knee." To this day, there is still no official death count. Hegseth's comments came a few weeks after President Trump signed an executive order rebranding his agency as the Department of War.
This is something we thought long and hard about. We've been talking about it for months, Pete and I, and I think it's a much more appropriate name, especially in light of where the world is right now.
From the Russian invasion of Ukraine to the Israeli-Hamas conflict in Gaza, the same dynamics of Wounded Knee, of civilians being killed by conquering military forces, continue to play out all around the world, according to David Martinez.
And I would go further and say that what you see in contemporary American foreign policy was forged in America's battles with Indian people.
He is Akamel Otham, founder and director of ASU's Institute for Transborder Indigenous Nations.
Wherever you see America invading, sending troops, trying to intimidate, all that comes from America's original attitude towards the so-called frontier, which was regarded as wild, which was regarded as dangerous, which was regarded as full of savages.
From the Utes across modern-day Utah and Colorado to the Apaches in Arizona and New Mexico, the Army fought over a dozen conflicts, predating federal recognition of tribal governments.
There is not a tribe anywhere in North America that did not experience deep historic trauma.
Even the Bureau of Indian Affairs emerged in 1824 from within the original War Department. Two centuries later, Martinez suggests it's fitting that Trump has restored the agency's old moniker.
Well, for me, the Department of War is the true name because from my point of view as an indigenous person, the objective in America's conquest of Indian country was to make Indian country like America. It did so at the expense of Indian land and people. And so the reservation system that we see around us today, which includes my people, Akimelo them, is a product of war.
Lakota attorney Chase Iron Eyes calls the reservations prison camps.
There are those of us who never perceived an end of war. If you look at what the reservation system is, it's not peace, prosperity, and privilege for Native people. It's a little open-air prison camp.
For Iron Eyes, who runs the Lakota People's Law Project, Wounded Knee is deeply personal.
As the great-great-grandson of people who were killed at Wounded Knee, nobody in their right mind takes pride in the slaughtering of non-combatants, women and children.
Marlis Afraid of Hawk grew up hearing horror stories from her grandfather, Richard, who was only 13 when he survived Wounded Knee. The 68-year-old Oglala Lakota elder insists Hegseth is wrong.
He's in denial. Look it up, but he's not going to.
Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. There are a lot of opportunities for fun across the valley. With so many choices, let KJZZ narrow it down. Sign up for KJZZ's Hotspots, and every Wednesday, we'll send some ideas to your phone in a text message. Visit hotspots.kjzz.org to get started. In science news. Earlier this year, the Vera C. Rubin Observatory in Chile released its first images taken of deep space, with one picture capturing about 10 million galaxies. Getting those kinds of images requires telescopes with really, really large mirrors, capable of gathering the necessary amount of light. As Greg Haney reports, the only place in the world making those mirrors is right here in Arizona.
So right back this way, actually.
Will Clodfelder with the U of A Stewart Observatory in Tucson is showing me around the Richard F. Karras Mirror Lab.
You're currently underneath some of the bleachers of the football stadium.
You heard that right. The lab is actually attached to the U of A football stadium, with some parts being below seats and extending eastward. There's a giant red furnace below, and scaffolding holds up a 28-foot wide circular mirror.
We are standing on the third-story balcony. That's on the ground floor. It's still taller than us.
Manufacturing incredibly large mirrors this close to Wildcat action sounds like a recipe for disaster, but Clodfelder says it's actually a great spot.
Football stadiums tend to have large electrical grids as well. We knew we were going to have that for our furnace because it is an electric furnace. And of course, being on campus was convenient as well. So this was actually a pretty good place to build this, even if it seems like an odd choice.
The furnace is where they melt the glass for the mirrors, and it can expand or contract depending on how big a mirror needs to be. And the furnace spins to create the slight bowl-like shape of the mirror necessary to focus all the light it gathers into a single spot.
And so you want to try to collect as much light as possible. Think of a telescope as like a light bucket, right? Imagine you have a 5-gallon bucket versus a swimming pool in a rainstorm. Which one's going to have more water at the end of the day?
That means the telescope will be able to see incredibly deep into space with precise detail. This singular mirror we are looking at is just one that has been cast for another observatory in Chile that, when all is said and done, will be 85 feet wide.
But we can't transport a mirror that big, and we don't know how to cast one that big.
Buell Januzzi is director of the Stewart Observatory, the research arm of the U of A Department of Astronomy.
But the giant Magellan Telescope uses 7 circular mirrors that come together sort of like a flower, where you have one mirror in the middle and 6 petal mirrors around the outside.
And the mirrors need to be really smooth in order to get the images right. So the team works to get all the bumps down to be smaller than even the size of the COVID-19 virus. So what exactly does this get you?
You can actually see volcanoes on the surface of Io, one of the moons of Jupiter.
The telescope will be 200 times more powerful than today's best telescopes. The GMT is said to be a sort of companion to the Vera C. Rubin Observatory. While Rubin is designed to make a large survey of the night sky for the next decade, GMT will zero in on faraway objects, like exoplanets or galaxies, for greater detail. How this technology came to be produced in Arizona goes back to the Cold War.
The path that ended up leading to these mirrors came, in some sense, out of fear and concern, and then moved into something else.
The mirrors are effectively hollow. Each has a singular reflective surface backed by a honeycomb structure that allows for insulation so temperature changes don't interfere with observations. Januzzi says this lightweight design can be traced back to plans for the manned orbiting laboratory.
That was going to have giant binoculars to monitor the Soviet Union.
Crews would have landed on the space station orbiting Earth, which would have those mirrors as part of binoculars for reconnaissance. The project never took off.
But the mirrors had already been made.
A previous director of the Stewart Observatory convinced the government to send those mirrors to Arizona. They were eventually used on the telescope at Mount Hopkins between Tucson and Nogales as the first observatory to use more than one mirror on a telescope. And now the giant Magellan Telescope is expanding on that concept. It recently made it to the final design phase at the National Science Foundation. Its first mirror was cast in 2005. That's why Januzzi compares this process to building cathedrals.
The reason I sometimes call the work we do at the Mirror Lab cathedral building is, and it's true for the larger telescopes that take a long time to build is that, like a cathedral, the people that are building it are not the ones that are going to be using it when it's completed.
The Mira Lab started some 40 years ago, and GMT is still 10 years out.
Like a cathedral, a human effort to try to understand ourselves through trying to understand the universe around us.
Greg Hawney, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News, dozens of Flagstaff residents weighed in on the city's contract with Flock Safety, a rapidly expanding company whose cameras are now operating in communities across the country. From the Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Michelle Marisco reports on the recent city council meeting where the debate unfolded Tuesday night after residents filed a petition to end the program.
Some of those who spoke against the cameras were supportive of Flagstaff Police, but not Flock. Flagstaff resident Alyssa Hughes.
How can we trust these AI cameras when they are put up without the consent of the people? How can we trust that our information is safe?
Flock cameras and license plate readers recorded nearly a 500,000 vehicles here in the last 30 days. Problems persist nationally. Police share data with Homeland Security, sometimes illegally. A Kansas officer used the cameras to track his ex-girlfriend, and police in Texas tracked a woman who had a self-administered abortion. Sedona ended its Flock contract after a backlash. The Navajo Nation government supports the program. Coconino County Attorney Ammon Barker supported the cameras but said there is an opportunity for oversight.
I believe this community is sophisticated enough to grapple with the tension between privacy and security without giving up either one completely.
The city is putting together a citizens task force to review its agreement. It's reducing the number of days it keeps data from 30 to 14. Police will only share data with area law enforcement. Councilwoman Miranda Sweet warned the city needs a policy.
Technology is here. We will be needing these policies in place.
Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In education news, the Maricopa County Community College District is moving its headquarters after more than 30 years near Broadway Road and Interstate 10 in Tempe. As Jill Ryan reports, the college's governing board approved the $27 million purchase on Tuesday.
District office operations are headed south, but not going far. The board approved the purchase of two buildings and a parking structure from Widewater's South Priest Drive Company, LLC. Widewater's had purchased the building from Target Corporation for $20.5 million in August. Records show ongoing HVAC and plumbing issues had been adversely affecting district employees at their current location. A maintenance study determined that necessary updates would cost around $55 million. The new HQ will be near I-10 and Warner Road. Jill Ryan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And KJZZ is licensed to the Maricopa County Community College District. In politics news, a new report shows Arizona military bases will host a large part of new National Guard force designed to quell civil unrest. From the politics desk, Cameron Sanchez reports.
According to Pentagon documents reviewed by the Washington Post, the Trump administration is developing a domestic civil disturbance quick reaction force to combat domestic disturbances. In Arizona, 300 troops will be on standby at all times, with purview over the western half of the country. Another 300 troops will be at the ready in Alabama. Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs.
We have received that information. We're still looking at what this means in Arizona.
A memo from the Pentagon this month calls for a similar but larger effort to train 23,500 troops across all states and territories to stop civil disturbances. Most states will be required to train at least 500 National Guard members for that effort. Those troops are expected to be operational by April 1st and will be outfitted with weapons and riot gear. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from KJZZ's The Show, here's the next installment in the Throwing Shade series. Can AI help us find the shadiest route? Here's co-host Mark Brody.
If you need to get from point A to point B, there are apps that'll show you the fastest route or the shortest route or even the route with the fewest tolls if you're in a place with them. But until now, you've not really been able to see the shadiest route, as in the coolest one in which you'll spend the least amount of time in the sun. Hua Wei is an assistant professor in the School of Computing and Augmented Intelligence at ASU and has been working on ways to incorporate artificial intelligence into making information about shade more available and accessible. The result? Two projects that come at the issue from different angles. As part of our occasional series called Throwing Shade, Wei joins me to talk more about his work. And Hua, how big of a role do you think AI could play in increasing shade and access to it?
I would say a lot, because right now, think about a shade or think about a simple map that we have in the map providers in Google or Apple. They don't provide any like shade map. And I think that is really something that we need in Phoenix, not only in Phoenix, but I feel like for the worldwide cities like in Paris, in South Africa, and in China, in Japan, we need that. A lot of cities are undergoing the heat wave.
Yeah. So you mentioned something like Google Maps or Apple Maps, and it sounds as though one of your projects, which is called Shaded Route Planning, it almost sounds like it's sort of Google Maps, but instead of just having options for like if you want to drive, if you want to take public transit, if you want to walk, that kind of thing, it also adds an option for what is the shadiest route. Is that a fair analogy?
Yeah, you're right. So that kind of like a Google Map, but instead of telling you the fastest route, it can also tell you the coolest one or the combination, like 50% of fastest and 50% of coolest. So we use AI models to detect the shade directly from satellite images and line that up with the sidewalk and bike passes.
Do you find that it matters what kind of shade it is, be it natural or man-made, in terms of the kind of impact it might have on somebody traveling through a city?
I think it matters when you have different, when you are in different cities. I feel like in Phoenix, as long as you are in the shade, no matter it's a structural shade from the buildings or the tree, the shade from the tree, it helps. But for those cities who have like white heat, not dry heat, I think the structural shade matters more.
So let me ask you about the other project you're doing, Deep Shade. And this is one where it almost sounds like a planning tool where you can, you're sort of using AI to figure out where shade is going to be. Am I getting that about right?
Yeah, you're right. So that's sort of like a movie. So it actually predicts how the shadows will move throughout the day. It's a generative AI model. So you can ask, what does downtown Phoenix looks like at 4 p.m. tomorrow or 4 p.m. in July 4th. So they will literally draw the shadows where they should be.
And is this the kind of tool that you can use to sort of figure out, you know, if you want to have shade in a particular place, like what kind of structure or what kind of tree might need to be in that place to make it shady at a particular time, maybe even on a particular day?
Yes. Yeah, you're right. So I think this one is going to be very helpful for the urban planning. So if you want to have a shade over there at a certain time of the day, we can design how high the building or how high the tree should be and in order to cover that area.
So you mentioned, you know, this might be helpful in city planning and in trying to think about, you know, ways that this might be useful, you know, things like where to put a park or maybe where to put a bus stop or how to shade those kinds of things are ones that come to mind. But I'm guessing that there are instances that maybe aren't as readily obvious where this could be useful.
Yeah, I think like one direct thing we could the city planners can do is use the shade map that we developed to figure out where, which part of the city or which part of the route like do not have any shade. Then they want to connect some part of it to make sure there is a certain route that is always under the shade. Preferably, they would have pedestrians going from one direction to a bus stop, and they want to make sure that people commute to the bus stop, and that route, specific route, is under the shade. That is one direct thing that we can think of. The other ones I can think of is this: the schools and universities, when they are having students running through different buildings and how they can plan for the trees and for the buildings to make sure they have the shade covered for the routes.
Mm. So obviously Phoenix has a goal of having a certain percentage of the city, you know, with shade canopy. Have you had conversations with anyone within the city about how to maybe work with this tool to help make that happen?
Yeah, actually, we're really lucky to be in Arizona because the local governments here get how serious the heat problem is. And right now, we're working with city planning and sustainability teams to bring our shade data into the workflows.
How much do you think that this tool can help in that effort?
For example, like they can use the tools to spot areas that are super exposed, like neighborhood without tree cover or bus stops with no shade, and prioritize those for improvement. That is just a simple idea. But having actual numbers or visualizations help them make data-driven decisions, not just rely on intuition.
Well, and I guess when you talk about data-driven decisions, and you're talking about cities, that often also includes money. And I would think that cities would be maybe a little reluctant to spend money on shade, or maybe more apt to spend money on shade if they had, you know, a model like this that said, okay, this is, we're pretty sure this is going to work, as opposed to we hope this is going to work.
Yes, you're right. So this is going to be when they have a budget and where they want to plant or plan first, and this data and this quantitative evaluation gonna be the thing that gonna be helpful for them.
How else do you think that you might be able to use AI to solve the problem of shade?
I think AI is really well positioned to solve this problem, because previously, before AI, people are using like real simulations. Like they have to run, set up their simulators, and they have to know exactly where the plant's height and what is the building's height. They build 3D simulations, and they have to place where the sun could be in certain day of the year. But with the simulations or the AI's generative AI, we can just input text and the AI with well-trained data, and then we can basically generate shade very easily. We do not rely on the expert simulators anymore.
All right. That is Hua Wei, an assistant professor of computer science and engineering in the School of Computing and Augmented Intelligence at ASU. Hua, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online and on the KJZZ mobile app.